This is the Higher Ed Tech Podcast, Season 3, Episode 11. Back to School, Spring 22 with Dr. McDonald.
Welcome to today's Higher Ed Tech Podcast. I'm Tim Van Norman, the instructional technologist here at Irvine Valley College.
And I'm Brent Warner, professor of ESL here at IVC. We both enjoy integrating technology into the classroom, which is what this show is all about.
Welcome. We're glad you're here with us. So Brent, hopefully by the time this airs, you have had a vacation, a little time off over Christmas and winter break. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
Yeah.
And hope it was a good time.
Yeah, this is a little pre-recorded, but I hope so too. We're wanting to make sure that we're stepping in to the new year here. And so today we always say the show is about integrating technology into the classroom, but every once in a while we kind of go off, talk about other higher ed related things and less about technology. And today is one of those days. And so we are happy to have IVC's Vice President of Instruction with us, Dr. McDonald. How are you?
I'm doing well. So based on the timing of the broadcast, I guess I'll say Happy New Year and welcome back to everyone. Hope everyone had a wonderful break.
Thank you. So Dr. McDonald, how long have you been the VPI here? And can you give us just a little bit of background as to what brought you to Irvine Valley College and being the Vice President of Instruction?
Well, it's a long, complicated story. So to make it easy, I've been the VPI since 2016. But I, when I transitioned, I was actually at Saddleback as an assistant VP. So the VP at IVC had some minor surgery. So I came over to assist. And by the time we got into accreditation, started looking at some budget issues, like the job, like the college, like the people, started wearing IVC gear. And then, you know, one thing led to another, chose to apply. So then I became the permanent VP early 2017. So a little over 5.5 years, or going on 5.5 years now, I've been the VPI at IVC.
Nice. Well, we enjoy having you here. We're glad you're here on the show, as well as our Vice President of Instruction. It's been good getting to know you in that time.
Yeah. So Dr. McDonald, one of the things that we really wanted to talk about, we're partly having you here to talk about like what a VPI does and the decision-making process. But right now in particular, that is, there's a whole different world around it with COVID and all of these, you know, coming back to campus. I know that there are other schools that have been back to campus. At IVC, we're kind of like trying to come back to campus, but haven't always been as successful as some of us have wanted, or, you know, there's lots of shifts to online. And so we're seeing a lot that, you know, students are and faculty are trying to make a bunch of decisions and coming back to face to face, and maybe not everything is normal. And so I guess just we'll start with broad. We don't need to get into today's details because today's details will probably change by the time tomorrow comes around. But we did want to kind of just ask you, I guess we'll start with the very big question is, when you look at COVID decisions, and when you're trying to do your job and, you know, create classes and have faculty with jobs and have places for students to go, and you're looking at the pandemic at the same time, what are the things that are key for you that you're trying to make decisions on, or that you're trying how are you trying to accommodate and make your job work at this time?
It's probably most helpful for the listeners if I take a sidestep first before answering those specific questions, because each executive is different. We bring our history, the sort of how we grew up in the system with us. So my view, when you're an executive, it's different from being, say, a dean, where you're more mid-management and you're closer to the action. So one way to frame it is the executives, we're really getting paid to make very few high quality decisions, right? When you're at the dean level, you're making a lot of scheduling decisions. You're working with the department chairs, faculty, students, and you're really, it's really high touch, high action, right?
Right.
Now, why do I sort of have this view? Because other executives might disagree. So my personal view, you're executive, you're getting paid, you're making a small number of high quality decisions. Well, I sort of grew up in the system, and I grew up in the system at Mount SAC, which is a very big college. When I left Mount SAC, they were about 67,000 students, right? And at our peak, we were around 15,000 students. I was chair of math and computer science at Mount SAC, so which means math CS background. So how we look at, how I look at data might not be the same as how other people look at data. The sort of things I try to do, a lot of that has to do with the discipline training. And then when you grow up, so you're a faculty member and you're in this large department, right? The math department at Mount SAC, when I was there, was serving over 10,000 students of the 67,000 per primary term, right? So if you think about it, right, none of my deans are serving 10,000 students currently at IVC. We're a much smaller college, right? So you get a sense of complexity and volume, where if a couple percent of your students have issues, you're busy as a chair at that level, right? It, when you're dealing with, you know, a lot of faculty members at that level, I'm just talking department level, right? Over 42 right. full-time, over 100 part-time that you're scheduling, a couple of them, you know, have issues per term, you end up being busy. So you get a sense of the need to prioritize and the need to be able to break things down and get things out to large groups of people in sort of bite-sized chunks, because the complexity is going to matter a lot, right? So if you fast forward, then being sort of like a dean of math, science, engineering, the math was no issue. The computer science, no issue. In fact, I had chemistry through organic, so I was okay there. But if you got into biology, and I had the physics that, we taught, but if you get into the biology, you know, you're out of your comfort zone, right? So then again, you're taking a more broad view. How do you take care of a whole population, right? Mm-hmm. And the decision making, because in our participatory governance model, you can't run out too far ahead of everyone, because you will alienate, isolate. And one of the biggest things you run into as an administrator, even in tough times like COVID, it's that it's very easy to violate the process in trying to accomplish things. And if you violate the process, you still have the substantive issue that you're dealing with, COVID or whatever it is, but now you have a process violation in a union environment where you have protected classes of people that deserve to participate in the dialogue and deserve to be at the table, right? So when you start looking at it like that, and then now you get to the vice president level, you start feeling sort of the weight of the institution on your shoulder at certain points in time. Now, because I know Tim, I'll digress and get closer to answering your question. I know I haven't gotten to answer your question yet. But okay, so I want you to think about this framework. If I'm going to make very few high quality decisions, so people actually don't know what I do all day, because I'm in the office. You can just walk in and see me. It doesn't look like I'm doing much, but there's a lot of reading. I read everything. You have to process everything. I have to analyze everything. So there's a lot of time just at the machine building the framework to make decisions. So when you're in these leadership roles, my view, you have to live in the past, the present, the future, right? So I'm constantly looking, where were we? How did we get to where we are right now in this moment? And what might it be? Now, Tim can attest to this. About 2 weeks before we closed the college, I had a meeting. Tim was in my office, right across from where I'm sitting now. And I'm like, Tim, you know, based on what I'm seeing, let's prepare to close the college. So I need you to go off and do a significant amount of work. Let's just prepare to close the college 2 weeks early. Now, most people weren't in that place at that time. And by the way, it took me a week to get to Tim. So in my mind, I was preparing to close the college a week before we got to Tim. So the question is, why so early with that mindset? It's watching the rate of growth of the virus. inadequate data sets at that point when you were talking about end of February, early March. Seeing the reaction in Asia, seeing what was going on in Israel, seeing what was going on in the UK, and trying to extrapolate to where we are, right? So I will be honest. I mentioned earlier deliberately that biology was my weakest. I had one bio class. I had the physics sequence we teach at the community college. I had the chemistry sequence, one bio. It's all I had to do as a math and CS major, right? All of a sudden, what do you do when you have one bio class? Now, I knew the statistics and I knew how to, you know, evaluate the mathematics about, you know, exponential growth and what might herd immunity back then when we were thinking we could get the herd immunity and how do you do all these things in the absence of a vaccine. So that part was okay. I then had to become a quasi expert in an area that was not my academic discipline because I needed to become a quasi expert in that area in order to make effective decisions. Remember, I'm only making a few decisions. I'm not making lots of decisions, but I'm making a few consequential decisions. When do you decide to put classes online, right? When we think of building and construction, right? And we learned initially that, or initially we were afraid it was surfaces. And, you know, we didn't know if it was more airborne, more surfaces. By June of 2020, we learned it's more airborne. Okay, you get guidance from, you know, health organizations. Your air filters need to be MERV 13. Well, what does that do when our mechanical systems can't handle a MERV 13 filter? So you start going after all these little sub-disciplines you have to get into. And it's just a lot of time sitting down at the computer, doing the research, not looking at YouTube and not looking at, you know, CNN or NPR, actually going to primary sources, trying to get a good sense of where we're going to go and trying to get a sense of how we're going to keep the community safe. I think one mistake, just to wrap up, one mistake I think we've made is that it's very hard to get this particular bit of communication out. And the communication really is what's the goal. My personal goal and how I've made the decisions and I try to communicate it to my team is we're trying to minimize the healthcare system being overrun. My goal has never been to eliminate 100% of COVID transmission. Otherwise we'd all still be home. You don't bring anyone back, right? But it's how do you not overrun the healthcare system? How do you minimize, you know, outbreaks on campus where you have community spread on campus, and we've been able to avoid that. So it's sort of that kind of focus in terms of the decision making. And the last bit is it's just daily. By the way, some people think I enjoy it. I don't enjoy it. The fact that I can name all the variants and all the lineages and talk about all the different studies, you know, if I weren't talking to you now, I guarantee there is a few sites I would be on right now looking at what's going on today with Omicron, right?
Yeah, so one of the things that we were thinking, or, you know, that's always struck me for you as a VPI is because of your math background and computer science background and the analytics and all these things is that you come from a very data-based decision-making process, or at least that's the way it seems to me as a kind of more, you know, person along the literature and humanities side of things, right? And so, and I know that some people struggle with that. I really appreciate it. I think it's really useful and a great way to deal with things. But like, when you're going and getting that primary source information to make these kinds of decisions, you know, where are you going? Where are you getting your data from?
All right. So if someone wanted to replicate what, and I usually put the links when I present to like instructional council or to the governance committee. So I usually have the links. So what you do is you go to the CDC site and you go to the NIH site. And if you drill down beyond just the data tools that show you a snapshot of the vaccines and all that stuff, they have articles. Those articles have primary sources, right? You could actually, if you cared to, even the South African data, right? You can go to the World Health Organization, you can drill down to the actual sources they're using from South Africa, and then you start, then you're able to look at the studies. So the good news is the information is all public. The part that's tough is it's possible to look at a study, and if you don't have sufficient math background, they might be hard to get through. If you haven't spent a fair amount of time already looking at sort of the mechanics of COVID, right? Because when, if you're reading a study and you're talking about, you know, antibody responses, and you haven't paid attention in, and you're not immersed in antibodies, you know, T cell, B cells, you know, sort of how the mechanics actually work, they can be a little tough to get through. But if you do it for a month, right? So I'll admit, the first month, I used to beat my head against the things, right? But now, after a while, I can read studies, not just read the abstract. I can sort of get a little bit, you know, get down deeper into the study and not understand 100%, but understand enough to know if it's going to be valuable. Then part of the thing that you might be seeing, right, when you're like, oh, it's a lot of data and analytics. When you're in my role, I have to filter what pieces. I can't come in and just put, if I were to put up all the data on a slide, it's what are the relevant pieces? So again, I go to the primary source because all reports are filtered, right? Even my report that you see is filtered, right? So my focus when I'm looking is, okay, how, like data from South Africa, let's take that. Does their population look similar enough to the US? Okay, maybe, maybe not. We seem closer to the UK and we tend to follow, they tend to follow Israel. All right, in terms of vaccination rates, in terms of you know, prior infection with the various variants, so I'm looking at that as a filter, right? Then it's like, okay, how does that translate now to Orange County? So I'm sort of balancing my local community, my sense of what our population might look like. By the way, it's a lot of guessing. This is not an exact science, a lot of guessing. And the data source, because every community is going to behave sort of different. But if you understand that most of the waves are about 180 days from the time it starts, you get to the peak, you come back down, you know, roughly, then you start looking at, okay, what percent is what? Sort of what is the R naught, how many people are each individual infecting, what sort of the replication or the doubling rate, you know, Omicron right now, depending on where you look, 2.3 days to double to 4 days. And you start doing extrapolation. So for example, without me doing my prep today, I would venture to say pretty confidently, we're gonna have a rough 4 to 6 weeks in the US because you got Delta, you got the flu, you got Omicron picking up. The Northeast is going to do worse than us because we, Florida and the South and then us, we already had our Delta wave. They're getting the Delta wave with Omicron coming in. So I'd venture to say that data wise, right, what I would choose to present is like the Orange County, the number of cases per 100,000 and the test positivity rate, right? Number of cases per 100,000. Right now, like I think, well, yesterday we're at 9.0, we might be at 9.2 today, I haven't looked, but somewhere in that range, right? But we made decisions when we were thinking about fall, if you remember, right before flex, when we passed 10 cases per 100,000, we moved classes online that were scheduled to be face-to-face, and we reduced the number of people on campus. Well, we're there now. And it's highly likely we're going to cross that barrier by the time you're by the time this podcast is aired. So I have to start thinking now about what kind of decisions are we going to make. The decisions to modify schedules, I make recommendations, right? Because we try to have the colleges do something similar, air quotes, it's not identical, right? In terms of protecting the community, we protect the community district-wide, not just in our, not just at IVC. So then it's making recommendations to the president and the both colleges, and then that recommendation will go up to the chancellor, who would then consult with the with the board. So if you think of the amount of, like, I'm making recommendations and you have to get through, right, part of the governance process all the way to the board. So sometimes the decisions have to be made a little bit early on my part, which means I have to monitor, make a guess, right? Then what do you communicate? I'm communicating like really one number, cases per 100,000. It wouldn't make sense for me to get into all the little nuances of every little move. It's sort of, okay, you have a reasonable threshold. Everyone, can you understand the case per 100,000? Recognizing that you need a reference point, right? Because if I tell you 10, what does 10 really mean, right? Meaning New York right now, or last I checked, there are about 54 cases per 100,000 in the city, right? Massive. One of the reference point we use when California had their blueprint and we had that tiered colored system, right? So that was our reference point. So you have to have some reference. Then we have to be able to communicate something reasonable. And on occasion, people might say, well, why 10? Why did the executives come up with 10, right? In part, that was based on prior references with the California blueprint, right? So you're really just doing stuff like that and trying to make the best guess that's possible. Now, you did talk about like you being more from the humanities and the literature. So here's something I'll add. Although my academic discipline was math, I don't claim today to be a mathematician. So let me explain why. I don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking, ooh, you know, I wish I could solve that kind of math problem. I am more in the middle of the night. If I wake up in the middle of the night, you're more likely to find me reading in the social sciences. Now, you know, did I recently go through, you know, David Hume? Ah, sure. You know, will I read Nietzsche? You know, that's my Jamaican pronunciation, by the way. Sure. But what you find is if you're thinking about, because I, you know, I'm thinking about your show now and sort of technology and sort of decision-making. For me personally, I like to read just a wide variety of stuff, right? So you're always sort of going back, filling gaps. And I prefer reading physical books, textbooks. I actually like textbooks as a thing because, so I'll give you my secret. Like, why do I read textbook that faculty give me in their discipline? Textbook have a way of giving you a summary, giving you details, and they'll read a lot of them. If it's something mechanical where you have examples, they walk you through examples, then you'd have the homework set. So I don't do the homework set, right? But because you get a summary prior to getting the details and you have examples worked out, I just sort of enjoy sort of the flow of the textbook format of being a way to learn. I know not a lot of people like textbooks, but I love textbooks. So periodically I borrow textbooks from faculty. I haven't borrowed one from you yet. And I just sort of, you know, work my way through textbooks and all, you know, the different disciplines. And believe it or not, having sort of that broader perspective helps versus a more narrow focus on the same type of thing all the time.
That makes sense. Wow. Thank you. This is enlightening, especially as having been involved in part of those meetings like you were talking about. Yes, I remember you sitting across the table from me and saying, I want you to do this, you know, be prepared for that 2 weeks. And I believe there was something in there about, you know, can you do this by Friday or do this by next Friday or something like that? And I thought it was an impossible task, but because you asked, you know, figured out how to make it work, but that's good. No,
it made me feel bad. You know, put a lot of pressure on you.
you challenged me and, you know, we all had to rise to the occasion. And, well, and that was great.
Communicating a sense of urgency before everyone else knew there was a sense of urgency.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, and what? I think it was 3 weeks later that we closed campus. So
it's so fascinating.
We were making a bet, you know, there's something interesting with decision-making. So if you look at the social sciences, right? If I just say something is likely, that means different things to different people, or if it's probable. So there are times where I'll just force myself to put a number on it. So what you didn't know is, I think back then I had put a number of at least an 80% chance we're going to close. So it's how do I gradually get everyone ready to say, hey, you know, if I just say it's likely we're going to close, that's not a sense of urgency. If I say, you know, there's an 80% chance. Now, you could be wrong, right? But when you're doing forecasts, what I find, and this is not anything to do with the math or, you know, the game theory classes and stuff. It's just, if you try to be disciplined in the thinking, right? And by the way, all our personalities are different. I just happen to have the weird quirk where I want to put a number on as many things I can if I'm making decisions around people's lives, people's livelihoods, and safety. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who don't think like I think come to similar conclusions or do something slightly different. Like it might look completely different, but they still end up taking care of their community and the population at large, right? So it's this force, okay, put a number on it. What do I think the likelihood is? And then if I can't find evidence to change that number, I just gamble that, hey, you know, if Tim does all this work and I'm wrong, I feel bad for Tim, but the college would be ready. Does that make sense?
Well, and in my head, you didn't know this, but in my head, my assumption was we would not come back from spring break. So I was only pushing it a little bit further than you were. But in my head, you gave me that impetus I needed to finish that off. So, you know, thank you. And that's part of why we wanted to bring you on, is because getting to know that as we're looking at the future, because you, as you said, you live in the past, the present, and the future. So we're looking at the future. What challenges are you seeing to students coming back, faculty coming back, even staff? Most of the staff are back at least part-time. What are the challenges that you're seeing to that or in that process?
The big challenge is the unknown with Omicron, right? Now, trying to keep the community safe, right? So airborne virus, you know, you put HEPA filters in, right? But HEPA filters don't work as good as we might assume, depending on what study. Don't look at the manufacturer-sponsored studies, because then they're all wonderful.
Right.
So what happens is, like, in my office, I don't know, I haven't tried to touch the ceiling, but I'm assuming it's about 10-foot ceiling. HEPA filter would work well in here. But you take some place where you have, you know, 3.5 stories, I don't know, like maybe the library student services center, where the ventilation system is much higher, right? They're going to be less effective, right? Your traditional ventilation system is not going to filter down to the level of 1 to 3 microns at 99%. So, you know, you're getting good airflow, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's 100% safe. So we have to have masks indoors, right? So if you're not going to get the ventilation perfect, then you have to have masks indoors. I don't think that's going to be a challenge right now, because I think people are just the expectation that they're going to have masks indoors. Surfaces, we still worry about it, right? So making sure when students flow in and out of areas, we're still wiping things down, right? So we don't ignore surfaces, but that now requires a little bit of coordination with faculty. Because some of the faculty coming back, think about it this way. If you're a faculty member in the labs, right, of any type, you're probably more attuned with directing students to do X or Y for safety reasons and not. If you're a faculty member in the languages, you might not be as attuned to remembering to direct students to do X or Y, right? So you do have to expect that there's going to be a learning curve for some of the faculty coming back, right? Another thing I have to worry about is when you move programs, people back to remote work, you can't just move them and then 180 days later easily bring everyone back. You create this disruptions. Mm-hmm. So to have sort of maintain the integrity of the program and take care of people at large, individuals at that level have to make decisions. So the question is sort of, what's a challenge? A challenge is that the best way to serve students is that you're going to have individual deans work with their faculty and staff to make individual decisions. And it's not going to look the same across all units. That's a challenge. Right. Mm-hmm. Because remember, we're in a union environment with all protected classes of people who we're trying to take care of. And there's always optics about fairness. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say the broader political context around vaccine boosters is a challenge. Still, the context of fairness, when you want individuals at the local level making the call about the units, right? That's a challenge. In terms of the mechanical systems and the ability to clean and maintain, minor challenges there, but I think those we can work around. And then the broader conversation would be, or big challenge is, for students and the vaccine mandate and getting the students uploaded, verified. There are still some technology issues, most of the technology in place, uptake and glitches, you know, uptake's an issue, glitches we're working through, communicating to students. And students are, you know, interested because it doesn't matter if you send them 10 emails, they might get none. If you send them 5 text messages, they may or may not respond. If you call them, you see them anecdotally to get a higher response, right? So trying to get students to do what they need to do prior to the deadlines, right? Prior to this week, some of the deadlines that we've set were reasonable because a student could go get Johnson & Johnson, the J&J, and be vaccinated. Well, what happens last week is that when, you know, the CDC comes out and they're like, well, the J&J vaccine, it's the same, the old issue where it's rare cases with the blood clot issues, right? So they're now recommending Pfizer and Moderna, right? So if you're a student and you're not vaccinated yet, that now creates a problem to be fully vaccinated with 2 shots, right? So, you know I'm getting into the weeds there, but you start seeing the compilation of things that I have to look at and weigh as we're trying to take care of the community, right? And trying to figure out what to do, recognizing that a lot of decisions are going to have to be made by Flex Week, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to have those decisions made by Flex Week, it can't be 2 days before. Mm-hmm. So it's the constant looking ahead into the future, trying to make the best guess, and then trying to have enough time, which is usually week 10 days minimum, in order to get the communication out to have the best outcomes.
Yeah, this is fascinating. There's so many different aspects to consider with everything. And I think, you know, you're trying to recognize all the stakeholders and respect and respond to all of them. I want to take a little, kind of a step back or a little bit broader, but still looking at the future, which is, I'm interested in what you think the long-term effects on enrollment or in-person versus online classes might look like through all of this. I think a lot of us teachers are making guesses about like, oh, this is going to be this forever, or this is going to change, or, you know, and none of us have the crystal ball, but I'm just interested from your perspective, mm-hmm. how do you see the broad college landscape changing now that people have had so much experience learning and teaching online too?
All right. So I think it's probably going to be discipline specific mm-hmm. to some extent, mm-hmm. right? So that's going to be a factor in areas where you need a lot of hands-on type, so we don't have it, but let's say auto mechanics, right? But you get into some of those areas, you know, your chemistry, bio, the students have to actually touch equipment if you're preparing them to work in those fields. So we know right now, and it might shift, that there's a preference generally for, you know, non-lab, non-technical stuff. It seems like the students right now, and it might change, prefer online, right? So if you look at our registration patterns, right, if the same faculty, let's take the same faculty, if you offer a class online right now and the same class with a face-to-face component, in most of the disciplines that aren't lab activity courses type disciplines, the preference right now seems to be online. By the way, that wasn't the preference pre-COVID. And some of that could have been because we didn't offer enough online, as a percent of the overall offerings. So I believe that a lot student demand, where the students are going to vote with their feet, right? I think that has shifted some. So a larger segment of the population might prefer, and when I say population, I mean community college student population, might actually prefer online. Now, there are some students that definitely have a preference for face-to-face on-campus activity. So that won't go away. But pre-COVID, we were, if you throw Emeritus out of the mix, we were about, 17-18% online, right? I say I like to put numbers on it. It wouldn't surprise me if post-COVID we're 40% online. When I say post-COVID, what I mean is sort of, you get out of the sort of the phase we're in where COVID is more, you get your annual shot or two, and we just, are going to live with it till you can get it out of the population, and hopefully have it not circulate in the population at the rate it's circulating. But that could be, a year or two away where it's not these massive spikes and drops, just sort of a reasonable, amount of transmission. So you get to that point, I think we might get close to 40%. By the way, our sister college, depending on whether or not you keep Emeritus in or out, they were mid-30s, getting close to 40% online anyway. So I think we're going to move in that trend. Now, something we have to look at too is that at IVC, sort of our bread and butter is the students coming in who want to transfer. Now, we're a comprehensive college, but we have to admit, who we are, right? Well, a lot of those students now would have had more experience with online when they get to us, and they will continue to have more experience with online when they get to us. So if you look backwards into the pipeline, what we might see is more of a preference for online as we progress, right? So I don't think we're going to get to a point where even the faculty say, and I'll pick on biology, teaching bio, I don't think we're going to get to a point where they're going to have 100% face-to-face all the time, moving forward. It might more be hybrid, where the lectures are online and then you come in and you do the labs face-to-face. So that's sort of the world that I am seeing. We do recognize now that the technology has caught up. We know there are some, disproportionate, impacts in terms of access, but I'll be honest, when I was teaching math, I taught online a couple of times, we're talking in the early 2000s, and wasn't a fan, right? Mm-hmm. But the technology just wasn't there, in my view. The technology is there now, and it's more widely accepted, where I think we will likely, see that just sort of moving forward. I know faculty in multiple disciplines, if you think success and retention, the students, success rates haven't dropped, but faculty are concerned about students cheating. Faculty are worried about, so those are some big issues that we're going to have to figure out over time. But, there are enough smart people working at it where it'll work itself out. But something that's critical is when you go from 17% about online and we're moving into this new environment, over the next 3 years, how we look at online, the infrastructure, the amount of training, what we do in terms of policy, in terms of quality assurance, all that has to change. Mm. Because we're still in the midst of the pandemic, we talk about it, but it's still on the periphery because we're still day to day dealing with the pandemic, right?
Right.
So when you get to the endemic phase where it's a little bit more normal in terms of, the spread, and we can go back to looking at operations, we are going to have to put more resources, right? And students, parents' expectations, community expectations about quality are going to change, right? Because you want to provide this. I would argue that today, I can't guarantee that every student, the quality they had before is identical now. In a lot of cases, yes, but I don't think we're there yet, right? So we recognize we're going to have to put a significant amount of resources into that. So we're having those conversations, and those will ramp up in the spring because, you start thinking of your technology master plans, strategic plans. It's not just words. Those, we update them, right? But we're going to actually have to update them and put a little bit of resources and, some action into it over the next year and a half.
This has been this has been fascinating and definitely appreciate this, but I want to give you the opportunity to answer a little different question, but you've been touching on this the whole time. And that is, what would people be surprised that you do in your position? You've touched on a whole lot of things, and I think I've been surprised at a couple of things that you've mentioned myself, but what do you think people are surprised if when they find out that you do certain things?
So there are aspects of the job. So I'll qualify. So there are aspects of the job that I delegate, right? So, and what I do personally is I'm gonna just frame it in a weird way. The things that can cause harm to the college, I'm more likely to micromanage, right? So the fiscal health of the college and the district, the accreditation status, right? Mm-hmm. And things around student performance and student outcomes, right? So I kind of micromanage those a little bit. But most other things, I don't really micromanage that much. Now, when you think of the fiscal health of the college, something that might surprise people is that whenever you have like litigation or, you know, the higher level discrimination complaints and stuff like that, I am hands on. Right. So one of the things I do with those is my preference is I work with HR, I work with legal. So we don't involve the deans and the faculty, except that unless they must be involved, I take the burden there, so that the folks doing the work of taking care of the students and providing services to students can focus on taking care of students and providing services to students. So I do that. Something that might surprise folks that I do, and this is, by the way, just a personality thing. I never rush, ever. So you will not see, you might see me look at my watch, but you never see me run into a meeting. you never see me like running down the hall. What I do deliberately, and it actually surprises people. This is the most surprising things to folks. Find the time when it looks like I'm in a rush. If you walk into my office, I've got the time for you. If I end up a few minutes late to a meeting, I'll text. Here's why I make a point, it surprises people, that I'm never in a rush. You have all these things you're dealing with. Remember, it's a few high quality decisions, right? If a faculty member, student, staff, if someone walks into my office, trust me, it's important. People don't just walk into my office just because, right? So also, I know I have to go find people and find opinions, right? And I'm primarily doing it on the instruction side, not so much with student services, but like your door is open, people talk about an open door policy, right? But not everyone's going to cross that threshold because of the position titles. Not everyone, right? Not everyone recognizes that, hey, you can always just walk in, right? Mm-hmm. So I make a point to not rush, to find people. And I'm always listening for cues and I'm always trying to read the tea leaves. And what that does is there are times where a specific department issue, I might actually get involved and carry it through the governance process. Right? That actually surprises people. Hmm. Like, why are there some issues, you know, that I take to instructional council, I go to APTC, and I take it through the Senate that appear may or may not appear to be a department or a school issue. It's looking for the areas where we can make improvement, and you go around and you sort of listen. And then I put everything sort of on a schedule or on a timeline. And I grab individual issues and I walk them through. So the not rushing, trying to find the time to touch everything if I need to, and then walk away from some things that are running well. You know, a big thing I force myself to do, I can take guided pathways because it's one of the current ones, where we recognize that the folks who are responsible and in charge are doing a good job, and that if I just show up to a meeting and give a little bit of opinion, it might skew what they want to do because of position. Mm-hmm. So I just sit on the periphery. I might not agree with every decision, but they're doing a good job. So you allow them to do a good job. And then if they need me, I clear roadblocks and then I go back. So lots of the job is just sort of clearing roadblocks. I think you too can appreciate this because you've been involved enough. if you think of our roadblocks, sometimes it's fiscal, right? Budget stuff. Budgets are just about people, politics, and history, right? So how am I going to clear a roadblock? It's not by fiat, the vice president says. It's okay, who are the folks involved? Sort of, were there any political considerations for the allocation process in the past? What does it look like now, right? And then how do I manage the dialogue to get things through? So let's round it out. It's a lot of touching bases with people at all levels of the org at different times. People don't know that I do that. Seeing and recognizing the talents, the wishes of individuals that are running into issues, providing assistance to the deans, the department chairs, the staff to get some initiative through. I don't touch every initiative. And sometimes I just touch it briefly to get it implemented. And then I, you know, you assign the right folks and you have people do that. But lots of odd things. So it's, you know, counseling individual students when they end up in the office. You know, you're off meeting with people, because I'm trying to think like some of the odd things. You're off meeting with people like business partners, people in the community, and trying to assist faculty build programs. At the same time, working with the Senate, working with the unions to make sure that implementation of, you know, the big things are being done. But overall, it's, I think, day to day, if someone were to watch me, they'd be surprised that it's just sort of this fluid, you know, moving around, trying to make the best decisions possible. And you two probably know, you know, I'll admit it. I probably only get to 80% of the meetings on my calendar, and I'm not there the whole time because I'm often double or triple booked. But that wouldn't be a surprise.
Not at all.
Yeah, this is fascinating. We've gotten some real insights into like the process, VPI, but also your own approaches here, Dr. McDonald. But as we wrap up, we just want to make sure, is there anything that you'd like to share or that you'd like people to know or be aware of before we close out or maybe be, as we're stepping into the new semester?
It's not so much things I need people to know. It's just express an appreciation for patience. Recognize that none of us have all the answers. We're all trying to, pull together. We're all trying to make, a lot of change, and people don't like change. And I think the best way to exemplify, I just glanced at myself on camera and noticed my IVC logo is showing, right? So just a final thought. As we're trying to work through these complex situations, right? A recognition just from the social science literature that when you have diverse organizations, in terms of social trust, it's hard. We also have a history at IVC, you know, prior to me being here, where the faculty and staff didn't always trust the administration. Social trust was low. So just another part of my personality quirk, because you might say, how come you only see me in a shirt and tie, you know, rarely? I'm always in IVC gear. You know, part of the thing, if you, like I went to USC for grad school, when you go to places that have high school spirit, right, it actually, although the, you know, the faces are diverse, the ideas are diverse. When people recognize, the moment they see me, it's like, oh, it's not necessarily casual, it's IVC. I'm one of you, right? So we're all in the same boat together. We're all pulling together. We're all just trying to make it done. And, you know, if folks, if you're seeing the executives running around, we're no different from you, right? We're just trying to do the best we can. Yes, ultimately, we're responsible and in charge. Yes, ultimately, we can be called to the carpet, but we can't do anything without the faculty and the staff, right? So it's just want folks to know that there's a level of appreciation for the patients and the level of appreciation for what everyone's doing. And that, you know, if you've got good ideas, you know, I'm always willing to listen to good ideas. You never know when, you know, I might implement if it's now, sometime later, but I catalog the ideas, I keep track of ideas, and I'm always willing to talk to people, see how things are going, and to make sure we're just moving forward and doing the best we can.
Thank you. This has been a very enlightening episode as far as I'm concerned. I appreciate you coming.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time, Dr. McDonald. We're really grateful to have you, and hopefully this insight helps other people too.
Absolutely.
Well, we hope so. But hey, you know, if you tell me at some point that you end up with, you know, some high-rated podcast on iTunes, you know, invite me back.
Oh. Glad to.
Will do.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening today. In this episode, we talked about back to school with Dr. McDonald. For more information about this show, please visit our website at thehigheredtechpodcast.com. There you will find our podcast and links to the information we've covered.
As always, we want your feedback, so please go to thehigheredtechpodcast.com and let us know your thoughts. And of course, if you have ideas for future shows or people that you'd like us to talk to, there's a link on that page where you can give us your ideas.
For everyone at IVC that's listening, if you need help with technology questions, please contact IVC Technical Support at extension 5696 or by emailing ivctech@ivc.edu. If you have questions about technology in your classroom, please contact me, Tim Van Norman, at tvannorman@ivc.edu.
And if you want to reach out to me about the show, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Brent G. Warner.
I'm Tim Van Norman.
And I'm Brent Warner, and we hope this episode has helped you on the road from possibility to actuality. Have a good semester, everybody.